Hello, this is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the December 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with the article that I didn't get to finish last week about the band The Cure, and then an article about Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in 1982, and a classic album review of NWA's Straight Out of Compton. And I'm beginning with the article that I didn't get a chance to finish last week about The Cure, titled Lonely Planet Boy. Haunted by bereavement and disintegration, The Cure's Song of a Lost World, their first album in 16 years, is finally with us. But what's it all about? And will it be Robert Smith's last? Often seen as the soundtrack to an eternally doomy adolescence, judges Victoria Siegel, The Cure might just be coming of age. And this is where I left off last week. Tolhurst, who has known Smith for 60 years, it's like family, you know, understands this new directionness through the context of their upbringing. Our childhood was very strictly Catholic, and it encouraged you not to show anything. It's a lifetime's labor to get to that point where you feel you can. Now it's like, well, if I'm not going to say what I really feel about things now, completely and transparently, when am I? Because it's going to be too bloody late soon. Since he curated 2018's Meltdown Festival at London's South Bank Center, Smith has regularly promised a follow-up to 2008's 4/13 Dream. Just a few vocals to complete. Just some missing to be done. The title, Songs of a Lost World, was revealed in 2019, and a tour named after it in 2022, but still no record emerged. Before September, Smith would say, by spring, this year, absolutely. I can't stand the anticipation much longer, Smith joked in March 2022. It's killing me. Tolhurst links this delay to a kind of perfectionism that was baked into The Cure from the start. For the first 3 years, we would just rehearse, he recalls. By the time we got to play in London, we were 19 or 20. People were like, wow, you can play. We came out pretty well formed, which I think is the way Robert probably still likes to do things. He doesn't let anything out, let anything be seen until it's completely done and right. Smith, meanwhile, can sound like he's questing for an almost intangible grail. When it gets done, it will be the best thing we've ever done, he said in February 2020. Which is why I can't afford not to do the best vocals I've ever done. It's not about tone or notes, it's emotion. It's trying to capture that point where you feel something enough to communicate it, but you don't break down, 'cause I hate myself when I do that. I want it to be perfect, but it's really hard for me to just get the right moment. In 2021, he was even harder on himself. I was listening, thinking, this is the best music the band has made, and my words are trivial. Last year, I just gave up. I thought, I can't do it. They can all be instrumentals. Smith stuck at it with striking results. Indeed, on a record so alert to the cataclysmic effect of mortality, it's remarkable how fundamentally unchanged Smith's voice is, uncrackled into a Bob Dylan croak or plunged to new Leonard Cohen depths. Yet, there is no kittenish levity on this record. Nothing approaching a pop song, no equivalent of Disintegration's spidery lullaby to break the mood, the never-enough grooves of the spectacular drone, non-drone slide closest to a gear change, but even then, the ground is unsteady. "I'm breaking up again," sings Smith. Disintegration, in other words, with all its oceanic expanses, its cold, glittering light. Opener Alone is the first station on the album's audaciously bleak, beautiful journey. Once this song was written, I knew that Songs of a Lost World album would be made, writes Smith, acknowledging the inspiration of Tublicher Victorian poet Ernest Dowson and his poem Dregs. The fire is out and spent the warmth thereof. This is the end of every song man sings. It's a telling addiction to Smith's lace-edged, blood-speckled treasury of Poe, Rimbaud, and Baudelaire. Here's a little bit of that song, Alone, by The Cure. Alone's pain is couched in universal terms, and nothing is forever comes from a very specific set of circumstances, a promise I made to someone that I would be with them when they died, Smith writes. But for reasons beyond my control, I didn't keep that promise. It upset me dreadfully. There's a painful escalating catch in Smith's phrasing. twisting the opulent backing into something more desperate, the light of an implacable pink moon, just detectable in the piano. Yet, if death is at the core of Songs of a Lost World, it's not the only loss. The torrential dialogue of A Fragile Thing rolls in the deepest romantic gloom. "Every time you kiss me, I could cry," she said, while War Song, opening with a martial drone, remnants of Disintegration era rarity, Pirate Ships is flooded with deep emotional water. War Song is about someone who, over the decades, I've kind of fallen out with, made up with, fallen out with, made up with over and over, Smith reflects. Yet, he says, it could be repurposed as a wider lament for humanity. All we will ever know is bitter ends, for we were born to war. And here's a little bit of the song War Song from The Cure. Another kind of loss explored by Songs of a Lost World is loss of self, a concept refracted in the crunched spine funk of drone. No drone, inspired, says Smith, by a drone that flew over the singer's garden, throwing him into a confusion of doubt. Was he being spied on or not? Smith doesn't know what to think, and not knowing what to think is almost worse than being watched. Yet, it's also a song about not being sure who you are anymore, even if your identity, your image, seems to be as solid as Smith's. All I ever am, meanwhile, pushes the rock star towards the nightmare of a dark and empty stage. An unfillable void, Smith says, it's about how hard I find being in the present moment is. Informed by questions of how I remains, I through time. I know in my head that I am the sum of a multitude of other younger versions of me. But there are moments when I just can't believe it. I just can't accept it. That strange feeling of disassociation peaks and ends Song's grand celestial collapse, recorded around the 50th anniversary of the moon landings, and testament to Smith's lifelong stargazing tendencies. I was outside looking up and back a lot that summer, lamenting age and an increasingly broken world, and always seemed to return to the same two questions. Where did that old world go, and where did I go? Insong might feel like an asteroid-sized extinction event, full stop. But it is not impossible that the cure could simply, by entering another phase in their remarkable career. The album artwork looks like an ancient stone head, an Atlantis relic. Its features so worn, they're barely visible. Yet, it is a 1975 piece by the Slovakian sculptor Janez Parnat, and the face could just as easily be emerging from the stone as vanishing into it. The band have faced cruel recent setbacks. Keyboardist Roger O'Donnell missed their 2023 South American dates to be treated for aggressive lymphoma. But Smith has not given up completely on the world. Ahead of the Oasis controversy curve, he played a spiky-haired Robin Hood when he took on Ticketmaster over their pricing for the shows of a Lost World tour. The band had already declined to take part in any surge or dynamic pricing when he became aware of the high fees. Smith also spoke out, securing a partial refund for fans, when an Italian fan on social media nudged him towards eco-vinyl concern Naked Record Club, two songs, I Can Never Say Goodbye and Nothing Is Forever, were released with profits going to Brian Eno's climate charity, Earth Percent. The 5,000 copies sold out in 2 hours. It's worth remembering before any valedictions, too, that Smith has long promised not one but two albums, as well as a solo noise LP. I talked to Robert, and he said, I'm going to do this album, and that's kind of it, says Tolhurst. He always says that. That's it. The last thing. But I like the idea that he always had when we started off, that we should always look at everything that we do as the last time we're ever going to do it. It puts an intensity to your actions that you should have, because otherwise, why are you doing it? As I got older and met different artists who had been around for a long time, there's a sense of entitlement that whatever they do, people are going to like it. Robert's never had that attitude. He's always been, I've got to do the best version of whatever it is I'm doing. While The Cure are fortunate to have a regenerating fan base, the audience who have grown up with them will be staring down the barrel of the same gun as Smith, facing similar griefs, uncertainties, questions. With Songs of a Lost World, The Cure, often seen as the soundtrack to an eternally doomy adolescence, might just be coming of age. I don't foresee Robert swanning into his twilight years, sipping a margarita on a boat somewhere, says Tolhurst, smiling. Well, maybe, but the boat would be going somewhere to play a show. Okay, I'm moving on to the article about Tom Petty titled Between Two Worlds. In 1982, Tom Petty was a star and the Heartbreakers one of the hottest bands around. But fame, drugs, doubt, and internal divisions were taking a toll. In 2024, a reissue of Long After Dark and a long-lost Cameron Crowe documentary reveal a group walking a tightrope, thrashing around for ways to survive, let alone succeed. There was a lot of cruelty in the room sometimes. Unnecessarily, they tell Grayson Haver Curran. Stan Lynch was on the beach in Santa Monica when he realized his life had changed, that his adolescent rock star dreams were suddenly real. Lynch and another drummer friend, Robert Williams, had been jogging down the California shoreline when they heard one of Lynch's drum breaks blasting from a transistor radio. Tickled, they stopped to listen. That's when the duo noticed that three nearby radios were each playing a separate single from Damn the Torpedoes, the third album by Lynch's band, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Refugee, Here Comes My Girl, Don't Do Me Like That. In the dawning days of 1980, this wasn't a blip. This was a phenomenon. And here's a little bit of the song Refugee by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. I'm from fucking Florida, and the last thing I remember, I'm playing in a titty bar for $50 a week. A grinning Lynch tells Mojo from the same Florida house he bought later that year. Now, I'm in a famous rock band, I guess. We're like a sauce, and the world is marinating in this shit. Just 3 years earlier, the Heartbreakers' rock and roll ambitions have seemed stillborn. Their self-titled 1976 debut had sold only a few thousand copies stateside when the band opened for Niles Lofgren in the UK in May 1977. And positive British press grew momentum. With Mike Campbell's serrated riff cutting beneath Petty's sneer, Breakdown had become a tardy hit, helping propel the Heartbreakers' follow-up album, You're Gonna Get It, to the charts only months later. That record, though, was but a minor prelude to Damn the Torpedoes. Financed by Neil Young / Joni Mitchell's manager, Elliot Roberts, and fixated over by producer Jimmy Iovine. As Petty wrestled his way out of the record contract that had drawn him from the Sunshine State to the Golden One, the Heartbreakers quickly became one of the country's biggest bands. The hitmakers at the crossroads of old-fashioned rock and the burgeoning new wave. Indeed, just weeks after that beachside epiphany, Lynch remembers leaving L.A.'s The Forum in a limousine next to Roberts, who blew smoke from a joint he just rolled into the drummer's face. The Heartbreakers had just played their first show there, and the car was bound for an after-party at the Whiskey A Go-Go. Lynch asked Roberts if they needed to let anyone know they were on their way, so they wouldn't have trouble getting past the crowds. Roberts just laughed. Elliot goes Crosby, Stills, and Nash would give their left nut to be hot. But right now, you're hot. One day, you may be rich. One day, you may be famous. But this is the best, Lynch remembers. He was right. But being too hot, of course, can burn, as Petty and the Heartbreakers were beginning to learn. A year later, their fourth album, Hard Promises, had not yielded the same payload of singles as Damn the Torpedoes. And the distractions were mounting. Hard drugs, intra-band dramas, financial dilemmas, looming divorces, outside collaborations, stalkers, tonsillitis, interviews. As Petty told Circus in January 1983, there are two things we can consistently do without even trying: spend money and stay in trouble. 2 months earlier, the band released their fifth album, Long After Dark. Its 10 tracks represented the apotheosis of their work so far. Petty's elliptical scenes of loneliness and alienation balanced atop a band with one foot in the past and the other in the future, with synthesizers and percussion pulling against Campbell's incisive guitars. Lynch's punchy drums and Benmont Tench's soulful piano. It's a good little rock and roll record with good songs and good playing, Petty told Paul Zolo 20 years later. But I don't know that we advanced a lot. In 2024, two expanded reissues of Long After Dark itself and of Heartbreakers Beach Party, an unexpectedly intimate documentary, Portrait of Petty, that Cameron Crowe made for MTV in 1982, but was only shown once, reveal what Petty was endeavoring to gloss. Here was a band wrestling not only with their sound, but also with fame itself, or how to remain what Lynch calls fingers on a fist. When the world seemed to be prizing them apart. Originally titled Between Two Worlds, Long After Dark finds Petty and the Heartbreakers inching toward an existential crisis. He would never talk about what songs were about, but they were always about our lives. Petty's oldest daughter, Adria, tells Mojo from her Connecticut home, a portrait and a doll of her father over her left shoulder. She has been methodically exploring and issuing his archive since his death from an accidental drug overdose in 2017. It looks like he's caught between two relationships, and this relationship with fame, wanting more of it or wanting to walk away from it. For much of his life, Petty had not been an obvious frontman, let alone a certain star. A kid of the lower middle class in Gainesville, Florida, Petty long seemed a shiftless misfit. At perpetual war with an unsatisfied father who worried he was gay, and so bad at school he once burned a hole in a report card trying to transform an F into a B with what he called special ink. His raison d'etre became rock and roll. At 10, Petty shook Elvis's hand when the star was making a movie nearby. He duly traded his slingshot for a stack of 45s and 2 years later had his first guitar. In that rapidly expanding college town, he wasn't alone. Instead, he was the unremarkable bassist for a string of cover bands, cobbling together gigs, even in Mud Crutch, his band after he bailed on high school and a series of hated manual labor jobs, he shared singing and songwriting duties for years. But Tench, the private-schooled son of a judge, recognized an uncanny bond between Petty and Campbell as soon as he saw them sneaking into a bar underage. He wanted in. There was some kind of extra charisma coming off Tom and Mike from the get. Tench says it felt different. Indeed, it felt different enough that, in 1974, Petty and a few other Mud Crutch emissaries headed west to Los Angeles with a demo. They returned with a record deal and an invitation to migrate. As they packed, Danny Cordell called with another offer from Shelter Records, an imprint co-founded by Leon Russell, then very hot himself. They accepted, left on April Fool's Day, stopped by Russell's famous church studio in Tulsa, and finally made it to Los Angeles. It was like being on Mars. Fast, crazy, intense, kind of exotic, Campbell remembers today. There were hookers walking up and down the street, flashing motel lights. As Stan put it, we were like rednecks in space. Though the band was excited to be in California and its vaunted record industry, the relationship didn't seem reciprocal, as if their departure date had been a portent. A rock band from Florida, Mud Crutch actually debuted with a reggae song called Depot Street, which Billboard said was the closest thing to actual reggae to have a chance to be a major AM hit to come along in some time. That didn't happen, and Shelter soon dropped Mud Crutch, keeping Petty and co-writer Campbell around as a solo act. Petty became a kind of accidental sidekick to Russell, tagging along to sessions with Brian Wilson, George Harrison, and Terry Melcher. These brushes with icons only made Petty long for what he'd lost. "It made me ready to be back with my people," he told biographer Warren Zanes. "Not rock stars, not session players, my band." Petty stumbled back into his band accidentally after Tench asked him to stop by to add harmonica to some demos. Lynch, another member of that fertile Gainesville scene, had also come west. He and Tench were scheming a cock rock concept called The Drunks, with a self-titled debut theoretically followed by Back for More, and a fifth album dubbed, well, a fifth. I Was Feral and It Was Wonderful, a logical extension of Gainesville, Lynch says. I was riding a stolen motorcycle to work. I would cash a check that wasn't mine, a street kid. But the idea for The Drunks evaporated on Petty's arrival. Everyone understood this was different. By the end of 1975, they had all committed to the Heartbreakers. By the end of 1976, they had released their debut, which Lynch stacked himself in the record store where he worked. They waited for the world to notice. The Heartbreakers were a squad, brothers, locked in, going to fight to the end to make this happen, Campbell says. We had one purpose, to make the band great together. We got Ovine bopping, Petty mutters, in his soft southern way, just off microphone at the end of Straight Into Darkness, a long after dark anthem about an innocent love corrupted. The album was finished and would be out in 6 months, November 1982, but Petty and the Heartbreakers were back in the record plant, cutting live studio takes for French TV rock show Hubba Hubba. There were hints of relief and sarcasm in Petty's voice, and deservedly so. Woes with the rhythm section had hamstrung the Long After Dark sessions, so much so they'd cost the Heartbreakers' original bassist, Ron Blair, and almost lost them Lynch, too. Blair was likely on his way out. Anyway, the road had worn him down, and he was daunted by the high stakes at this level of success. Everything was just life or death, he told Rolling Stone a quarter century later, and it just took its toll on me. He bailed on a week-long band vacation in Florida and rejoined them alongside his wife, Liz, a faux pas for this marauding posse. He recorded The Prowling Beneath Two Worlds with the Heartbreakers, the first song they cut for Life After Dark, and was soon gone. We played with a couple of different bass players, including Graham Mabey, who played with Joe Jackson, a great bass player, but his sound didn't fit in, remembers Tench. But the day Howie showed, it's who's this guy? He knew stuff of ours that hadn't been released. He left more space, and he grooved like mad. Petty met Howie Epstein, a Milwaukee multi-instrumentalist, drawn to California for a gig with John Hiatt, while producing Drop Down and Get Me, a kind of comeback for early rock crooner Del Shannon. Epstein's knack for high harmony worked like catnip on Petty, an Everly Brothers accolade, and he recognized Epstein could add welcome vocal reinforcement. Petty had struggled with tonsillitis and vocal cord nodulars in the early 1980s, forcing him to cancel or postpone shows. The main difference, as Petty put it simply in record, is that now we sing a little better. The addition, however, made Stan Lynch less indispensable. He was, as Tench remembers, a fantastic harmony singer, but Lynch admits he was anything but consistent. Howie could sing, man. I was back there screaming my brains out, trying, and sometimes I'd get it, Lynch says, but Howie never had a bad night. Since Ovein enlisted as the Heartbreakers' producer for Damn the Torpedoes, however, Lynch had had quite a few bad days. During those sessions, he was fired, quit, and rehired multiple times, with session drummers recruited to no avail. Ovein knew Lynch could play hard, but didn't think he grooved, especially in a way that would propel those songs onto the radio. When the Heartbreakers did a reported 70 takes of Refugee, they were hunting for a feel for a smash. During Long After Dark, the cycle repeated itself. Hard Promises hadn't produced a massive hit, and they wanted one. Petty's decision to keep Lynch around flummoxed Ivine. In his mind, Lynch says, I was eminently fucking replaceable, like I was in the way. Lynch and Tench were best friends in the Heartbreakers, the counterpart to Campbell and Petty's unspoken brotherhood. Tench saw his pal as an underappreciated listener, responsive to how everyone else moved. He couldn't comprehend Ivine's grievance. Jimmy hated the way he played, and I don't think they liked each other from the first minute, says Tench. I thought, what is this bullshit? But I had no sway over Jimmy, and Tom was trying to make the best record he could. But in neither case, Torpedoes or Long After Dark, did we get a single track from drummers we brought in, BJ, Wilson from Procol Harum, and Terry Williams from Rockpile, one of the best drummers ever. Tench continues, but the day Stan came back, we got two tracks. What the hell? Quit messing around. Looking back across four subsequent decades, as a session musician, songwriter, and producer, Lynch understands. He was a kid high on testosterone and anything else he wanted, pounding away because that's all he knew. He had yet to develop dynamics or subtlety. You're full of shit, and you're full of yourself, he says. He simply wishes the Heartbreakers had been mature enough to communicate beyond disses and dismissals. Being the drummer in the Heartbreakers was wonderful, amazing, but it tore a hole in my central nervous system, says Lynch, hesitantly. There was a lot of cruelty in the room, sometimes, unnecessarily, and I gave as good as I got. Everything wasn't copacetic between Ovine and Petty either. Damn the Torpedoes had been a breakout for both of them, and, much like Petty, Ovine had gone from a figure in music, industry, marginalina, to someone who, in Robert's parlance, was hot. He had dated Stevie Nicks and facilitated the chart-climbing collaborations between her and Petty. But according to Petty, he spent much of those long-after-dark sessions on the phone, often to Bob Seger, talking about The Distance, the other album he had on the go. More than once, Petty told Paul Zolo the singer took razor blades and kitchen scissors to the phone cord, literally cutting Ovine off so he would work. It was that album when I felt he'd betrayed me, Petty later told Zanes, doubling down. As I saw it, I'm a full-time job. Petty and the Heartbreakers cut 19 songs across multiple sessions and studios, but Ovine didn't think several of them fit the reputation they built at the nexus of classic rock's accessibility and punk rock's attitude. Don't Make Me Walk the Line was as radiant as any E Street Band jewel. Its pouncing piano and xylophone chimes making the lovesick song feel like a blatant bid for radio affection. With its cantering beat and warm group harmonies that recalled the Everlys, Keeping Me Alive sounded too country to Ovine, as did Turning Point, an optimistic anthem about hard times fading in the rear view. There were some advances. An avowed fan of Roxy Music's Avalon, Petty was a synthesizer enthusiast. They're the instrument of the times, and you should deal with them, he told Record. They splashed through the cracks of Long After Dark, like bits of stained glass making a room glow. Petty plays a Prophet 5, while Tench's Oberheim OBXA traces through several songs. Since Plunge In and Out of You Got Lucky, the first single, and a sneering taunt about a pending breakup, Petty compared it to Breakdown, except with more modern instruments. But for Campbell, it was a real coup, combining old and new ways of working. In a bedroom that's now part of his kitchen, Campbell looped a drum snippet from a record he no longer remembers with a TEAC 4 track. He added guitar and bass using a small Soundcraft mixing board, then took it to the record plant. They'd recorded so much of Long After Dark live, and this was a distinctly different approach. Lynch, Campbell said, added new life on drums while Petty inspired the guitar solo. I said, what do you think I should play? And he said, play something like Clint Eastwood, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, Campbell says, laughing as he sounds out those tremolo notes. That was Tom directing me. The one exception to Long After Dark's spring-loaded rock came at the end with A Wasted Life, a soft focus plea for someone Petty loves not to ruin their life with depression or drugs. Petty's first wife, Jane, had just given birth to their second daughter. Their marriage was fraying, though they would remain together for 14 more years. It was, ironically, the first time Lynch saw opium smoked in the studio. It helped create the weirdness of that track, says the drummer, shrugging. It was a desperate end to a dark album, Petty often writing as if he'd been cornered by fame, until he felt ostracized, lashing out at whatever and whomever neared. The dead ends of a one-story town, the dangerous possibilities of We Stand a Chance, the doubtful perspective of Deliver Me, when Ovine circumscribed Petty's sounds. He circumscribed his feelings, too. There was so much fortitude in those three records with Jimmy, says Adria Petty, but by the time the last one was edited down, it was darker. Tom liked to play with duality, even if he didn't know what to call it, where there was always hope. He always thought things had possibility. In the early 1980s, Petty was not exactly an easy or candid interview. His public fights with his record labels, first over an unfavorable contract and then over an attempt to charge more for his albums, provided easy fodder for inquiring journalists. But he started going only skin deep, choosing to talk more about the basics of production or the outline of his past rather than the real stuff that motivated his songs. After evading Rolling Stone's Mikel Gilmore for days, after losing his voice in 1979, Petty finally responded to a conceptual question about anti-heroes with, you know, I don't think about these things that much. But in an earlier Rolling Stone interview, before the songs of Torpedoes, catapulted Petty, Cameron Crowe captured a much more open person, an endlessly quotable prankster, who talked about switchblades in his boots and who could badmouth Elvis Costello and Johnny Rotten in a single thought. Recognizing this rapport, Danny Bramson, the head of Backstreet Records, the Heartbreakers' home since Torpedoes, contracted Crowe to make a documentary about Petty they could deliver to MTV to promote Long After Dark. Petty was in, with one caveat. It needed to be weird. This idea of it being a self-satisfied portrait, he was not into that, Crowe remembers. He wanted it to be cool and irrelevant, and not look like the corporate thing he'd just come out of a battle with. If he was going to splash around in those waters, fame by way of corporate promotions, he wanted it to be something that wouldn't be a compromise. Indeed, there are few portraits of a rock band so disarming, real, or goofy as Heartbreakers' Beach Party, named for an antic 1980 Heartbreakers number about a seaside cookout. It was screened after midnight just once on MTV. Crowe soon got a call from MTV executive Chip Rachlin saying it wasn't fit for the channel. Then barely a year old, it became an object lesson for Crowe, still years away from making Say Anything and singles. Not to bargain. Tom was quietly proud of it aired only once. So it became like Cocksucker Blues, he remembers laughing. You had to be there. When Adria Petty saw the footage last year as part of an archival dump, she was stunned. She remembered the film being shot in her family home when she was 7, and she recognized the assorted rooms of her childhood. But she didn't expect to see her sometimes enigmatic father opening up so much about songwriting, whether showing Crow how American Girl owed more to Bo Diddley than Roger McGuinn, or how much patience waiting for the lyrics to The Waiting required. And this is where I'm going to stop with the Tom Petty article, but I will continue that next week in order to have enough time for the Classic Album Review. The Classic Album Review this week is N.W.A. Straight Outta Compton, 1988. Album that took gangster rap out of the underground and onto the front pages after attracting attention from the FBI. Hard to believe that at one time, Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, and Ice Cube all fought for the spotlight in one powerhouse aggression. With MC Ren and DJ Yella, Niggas with Attitude etched the blueprint for West Coast gangster rap with Straight Outta Compton. The album was shocking in its graphic depiction of South Central LA street life and unrelenting in its young African-American male perspective. Without the global consciousness of Public Enemy, their closest competitors, N.W.A. played with explicit and sexist language and freely borrowed samples on songs set to some unusually hard, loud beats that raged at the reality of death, crime, and loss of racial pride. From the opening title cut Manifesto through the Built to Last jam, Gangsta Gangsta, N.W.A. delivered the goods from the front lines with keen reporters' eyes. Sirens screeched, gunshots rat-a-tat-tatted, and cop radios interfered, adding to the documentary style. Though Express Yourself, which sampled Charles Wright and the Watts, 103rd Street Rhythm Band, and Something to Dance To, cutting together Planet Rock and Dance to the Music, lightened things up, this was a record which begged to be heard at top volume. And that's how it was in the summer of 1989 when it blasted from car stereos and boom boxes. Here's a little bit of the song Gangsta Gangsta by N.W.A.
Say goddamn they ruthless. Everywhere we go, they say damn. NWA's fucking up the program. And then you realize we don't care.
But the group had its detractors. Ruthless anthem, Fuck the Police, which outlined police brutality in South Central Los Angeles, found attention in all the wrong places. The Parents Music Resource Center, PMRC, the U.S. organization headed by Senator Al Gore's wife Tipper, that campaigned to stickier albums whose material they considered questionable, declared it a danger to minors, while the FBI sent the group and record retailers a written warning. And here's a little bit of that song, Fuck the Police, by N.W.A.
In full effect, Judge Dre residing. In the case of N.W.A. versus the police department, prosecuting attorneys are MC Ren, Ice Cube, and Eazy-E.
motherfucking E. Order, order, order. Ice Cube, take the motherfucking stand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help your black ass?
You goddamn right.
Won't you tell everybody what the fuck you gotta say?
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe to toe in the middle of a sale. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the product. Thinking every nigga is selling narcotics.
Meanwhile, the band members, former drug dealer, now deceased, Eazy-E, a hot-tempered Dre, and an unrepentant Cube, were not doing much to sweeten their public image. The controversy helped them notch up sales of 750,000 albums before they'd even set foot on tour, cracking the top 40 in the U.S. and almost managing the same feat in the U.K. Follow-up for Zagan went further still, topping the U.S. charts. In Britain, its release was delayed after being impounded by the Metropolitan Police's obscene publication squad. The ensuing court case with Jeffrey Robinson, QC defending, was found in the band's favor, their barrister successfully arguing that it was street journalism and the black equivalent of our rugby songs. NWA also found supporters in the rock press, who likened Straight Outta Compton to the MC5's and Sex Pistols' watershed, revolutionary battle cries. And here's a little bit of the title track, Straight Outta Compton, by NWA. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the December 2024 Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article about Tom Petty and then the Mojo interview with Kenny Jones, who dreamed for the Faces, Small Faces, and The Who, and a classic album review of Vitalogy by Pearl Jam. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music, saying so long. And keep rocking.